Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me is Thomas Harper, and we are here to talk about the Bad Batch, which isn't bad, it's good. Tom, how you doing tonight?
I feel like I'm out of carbonite and I'm ready to go. I mean, it's realistically only been, what, 5 months since we were together for The Mandalorian, but it feels like an eternity, but it's just good to have new Star Wars in our lives.
That, and it's nice to once again have something else from Disney Plus on Fridays, because we've had Falcon and the Winter Soldier, we had WandaVision, before that Mandalorian, and I was feeling, what am I going to do on Friday nights now? You know, For All Mankind's, you know, done with season two. What happens now?
And or for some of us, very early Friday mornings before the sun comes up.
I, with this one, I've been able to wait until after work. If they're only 20 minutes, watching them early, I think I can handle that.
But I will fully confess here, this is my mea culpa for the episode. I didn't know we were getting two episodes this week. I missed that. I just completely, it flew right over my head. And so I got a notification on my phone Friday morning, like mid morning, I'm working. And I said, oh, it's probably a trailer for the next episode. And then I just clicked on it thinking, oh, I can spare a minute and a half or 2 minutes. And it's whatever the runtime is, 38 minutes. I was like, no, this is the episode. There's an episode.
It was like, what, 23 or something like that. It was a regular size up, you know.
Right.
That would fill a half hour time slot with commercials. Yeah. So
I felt it was like that feeling that I had done something wrong as a fan, even though that's ridiculous. No one can know that I didn't get up at the crack of dawn and that I had forgotten that there was an episode.
I do that for only Mandalorian. And maybe when we get to other Disney live action, I'll fall into that camp when it's, you know, Kenobi or Andor.
Right. Well, these days, I found in the wake of this episode, the spoiler culture around this one seems to be a little less. It's still a minefield on Twitter, particularly, to go out there and log on if you haven't seen it, but nothing like The Mandalorian. I mean, people were just rushing to put screenshots up and make GIFs of the coolest scenes. And so if you hadn't seen the episode, you might as well just stay off the internet until you do for that show. But this is a little more forgiving.
Yeah. And I can't stand people who do that. It's like, why do you want to ruin the experience for others? They suck the fun out and.
Be first.
Yeah. And be smug about it, as opposed to what a wonderful world where we live in, where we get Star Wars animated and it's fantastic.
Yeah.
Like, it's just so much to talk about. So it made me happy. What was your reaction?
I really, really liked it. And the joy that I had, my joy is never dependent on other people liking it. But when this show got announced, there was sort of what I felt was a knee-jerk reaction amongst some in the fandom, where it was almost like an eye roll from them, like, great, we don't need more clone content. And it was this feeling as if we were going to get sort of ready-made rubber stamp type material recycled from the Clone Wars show. They were just going to repackage it and use characters that some of those same fans worried would be just exactly how they appeared in the one arc that they appeared in season 7, and that there would be nothing else done with them. They'd just send them from mission to mission. And I was just so happy that that's not the mold that was used here, that in, what do we have, like 98 minutes-ish of material so far, that these are characters that people are starting to care about. They're doing things that seem impactful and are tied into the larger universe. Most of all, as somebody that, you know, has watched the Clone Wars and grew up with that series and whatnot, it makes watching, all the time spent watching those episodes and like reading some of the comics and stuff, feel worthwhile. Like, you catch the little things and the nods and whatnot, and it's almost like a little high five from the creators. Like, okay, you get this. Everybody else that hasn't watched it is not going to have any less of an experience. But you know, overall, it was just a great experience. I got that same feel. I get this like sort of odd feeling when I watch new Star Wars, where it's almost the first time through. It's like I'm in a haze. It's just like this is all unexplored territory, and I'm just trying to soak in every detail and resist pausing it every 2 seconds. But it was just fun, top to bottom, and I can't wait for the next episode.
Yeah, I understand. Again, growing up with Star Wars, the decades where it was not prevalent, and you know, we now have this age where we keep getting new content. You know, since it depends how you count, Disney era since 2015, pretty, you know, 6 years later, we've had what, 5 movies, and that's cool. And 2 seasons of a TV show, and we finished off an animated series, and we got a new one. And all the year, when did the Clone Wars animated series drop? That was the movie 2007.
8 was the start of the theatrical release, and then the first season followed on its heels, and then it ran through 2012, 2013, and then obviously you had the hiatus.
Yeah, and let's not forget Resistance and Rebels.
Yep.
And again, we've talked about all of them, and again, it's like, this is incredible that we have so much content, and we're getting more. And like, my reaction to the announcement was like, oh, that's interesting. Like, it wasn't, I wasn't excited, mm-hmm. but I don't get being disappointed, because I was just like, oh, that's it. Let's check it out. Let's see
how it is. Well, and that's the world we live in now. There's just so much that it used to be like, if you announced a show like this, I don't know, in 2006 or 1994, people would have freaked. It would have been all that anyone was talking about. But it finds its place. It finds its sort of shelf on the larger bookshelf of all the Star Wars content that's coming. I just, you know, nobody can see this because this is just all audio. But, you know, I look over, you know, to the side of my computer, and there's an entire bookshelf that's just filled with books, new content, visual guides and stuff that's come out just since 2015. And it just never ceases to amaze me. We kind of touch on this every time we do a podcast about a new series or a new season, but it really is just, you know, awesome. And I try to pinch myself every now and again that, you know, as a kid, I would have killed to just know that this was coming. Cause at the time it was like, I have to clutch really close all these, you know, these 6 movies. And then, you know, we got the prequels or these 9 movies after that, cause that was going to be it, but it's gotten so much better.
Agreed. There's just so much out there right now. It's we live in a wonderful world. And I am grateful that we get to talk about this stuff, whether it's about air races or fighting the rebellion, you know, fighting the Imperials during the rebellion. It's like, this is great. Yeah, I absolutely love it.
And they seem to make these things with all of us in mind. And by all of us, I don't mean the larger Star Wars fandom. I mean, Josh, you and me, everybody listening to this podcast, anybody who contributes to the Legal Geeks or has podcasted with us before, like our little very, you know, niche community, we get these little nods and plenty to talk about in these episodes. So I'm always grateful for that.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. And like, just jumping into the episode, I like these characters, and realizing that we were seeing a young Kanan, I was slack-jawed. And I've listened to other podcasts, you know, who were upset about, like, it deviates just a little bit from the comic. And it's just like, another, the reactions are mixed of like, I'm disappointed to get over it. And it's like, okay, I didn't read the Kanan comic. You know, I'm all for being consistent, but the essence is there. I mean, they could have gone with one of the younglings from one of the prior episodes.
Yeah.
And like, that would have been fine too. And there was no shortage of younglings that we've all I mean, the Wookiee kid would have been hard just because we would have had growls and not talking. But any who spoke a language would have been, you know, that translates.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, like seeing that was rough. I'm like, we heard a Jedi die. Like that's the opening of a kid's cartoon.
Yeah.
And we've talked about Order 66 before. Like that's clearly an illegal order, you know, when it's just commits summary executions of of people that you fought with for years. It's like, oh my God.
When, you know, I'll say this about this will be all I say on the deviation from the comic, you know, and if you're not familiar with it, there's a 12 issue short run of a Kanan miniseries that came out in 2016, 2017, right when Rebels was really at its height. And it depicts Kanan's experience during Order 66. But what I come back to is a comment from either Pablo Hidalgo or Dave Filoni himself on just the general idea of continuity and the interplay between comics and books and whatnot. Because this isn't the first time that there's been a conflict between something on screen and something on paper. And the way that they told it is that these are stories, right? They're stories that are being passed down, that are being told. And so they're sort of versions of what happened. So you can look at the comic in a way as someone's version they're telling you of what happened. If you hear the story told from a different source, that's what happened. And what weight you give to how it unfolded is all up to you. In my mind, I now give more weight to what was depicted on screen, but that's just me. That's why you see, you know, the novelizations of the books and then the books that have got, or excuse me, the films that have the novelizations of movies and then the comic versions of some of the movies. They're different. They just are, but that's sort of what they come back to is that's just the nature of storytelling and how things are passed down. And so, you know, I understand if you're bothered by it, but I think they have that. It's not like they're just ignorant. I think Dave Filoni looked at the comic and he said, I want to go a different direction. I don't want to depict it like this because now we have a different set of characters that are going to be involved. So, yeah, but anyways, I thought it was fascinating to start with Order 66 because the big thing that I wondered about coming into this was, well, how are they going to fit in? Are they going to have a Rex moment like we saw in season 7? Or is it going to be some other explanation? And I really love that the bulk of this episode was exploring that with a bunch of, you know, interesting legal issues along the way. And you didn't see like an in-depth discussion of it in any legal terms, but you saw this sort of fascinating moral dilemma play out because Hunter is immediately skeptical of what's going on because they had just been in combat with Depa Balaba and Caleb Doom, then, you know, later Kanan Jarrus. Everything's hunky-dory, and then all of a sudden the regs, the clones that they're with, are claiming that the Jedi have all been declared traitors. And I think there's a world, I think there's a lens that you can see Order 66 through where in the narrowest scope, there might be some legality to the order. And I say narrow very literally, because I mean, if you know, you want to point to the 4 Jedi that came to arrest Palpatine and try to make an argument around how they handled that and that sort of thing, maybe, I don't know. But it's hard to that argument gets stretched past the breaking point when you look at situations like this, or certainly the poor Padawans and younglings at the temple, Jedi who just weren't even doing anything and they just get summarily declared traitors and sentenced to execution. You know, even if they had been part of a larger plot, there's a little due process, there's proper treatment of detainees, there's a whole onion of layers of legal concerns that are there that are all kind of hurdles that you need to get over before you get to kill somebody. You don't just get to summarily execute prisoners or folks like that. So, but it was fascinating for the episode.
It was fascinating, and I appreciate Hunter going like, what's going on? You know, like, and, you know, and all but Crosshairs, who, since he's affected by Order 66, you know, they're like, what's, huh? Like, I mean, they're confused. They want to make sure that Caleb is not harmed, with the exception of Hunter, or excuse me, Crosshairs. And I can't help but wonder if Crosshair is fighting it on a subliminal level, because he doesn't miss. However, when he shoots Caleb, he shoots a branch out. And later when he's in the fight and he shoots Wrecker, mm-hmm. he like wings him in the shoulder, not a fatal shot. So like, is he, you know, like, you know, at a subliminal level trying not to kill people?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because again, he's the kill shot. Like, he doesn't... shoot the knife flying through the air and take out a droid. Like, he should be able to take out the big guy.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there's precedent for that with Captain Rex. As you know, he turned around and had that real poignant moment with Ahsoka where he tells her to find Fives and get out of there before he opens fire on her. So I think there's something to that. I had a chill run down my back when he uttered or muttered, "Good soldiers follow orders." It was sort of like, well, we know that something's not right in your brain.
It's like, no, no, that's a big red flag right there of, we don't like that.
Yeah.
No.
And you have this, conflict that sets up between them that really, I think, is going to drive through the whole season, but it starts with this back and forth between Crosshair and Hunter over whether an order was followed. That's what it really boils down to. And Hunter kind of goes from that and decides, well, if you're not following this order, you know, also don't forget that those who didn't follow Order 66 were themselves declared traitors. And then I have to question everything about you. You're now a traitor to the Republic. And it's just fascinating that it comes back to that. And we've talked about the legality of orders in the past. There's not really a question of whether it's legal or not in Hunter's mind. It's just, it's an order and they follow it. That's what they were engineered to do. But presumptively, orders are legal. And it's always controversial. It's even on a small individual one-to-one level, the moral choice that has to go into it is often made in a blink of an eye, because it has to be. And the military, whether it's the clone army or a real one, can't have soldiers out there constantly running through this long ambit of a thought process about whether what they were just told to do was appropriate. There has to be a moral, you know, a moral reflex there. Otherwise you end up with, you know, situations like My Lai or Order 66 on your hands. But at a base level, there's that presumption, because you can't have soldiers saying like, well, should I go mop the toilets, or is this illegal because I don't like it and I'm just going to decide that it's illegal?
Well, but the, you know, case law says it's illegal on its face. And so if that's
true,
if we use that as a baseline, it's like, so you want me to shoot a kid? That seems illegal on its face.
Yeah.
Just to gun down a kid.
And that's where Star Wars is excellent in making thing, in showing an extreme, like a black and white example that makes it a little easier to understand. And, you know, in real life, I think the ones that are contested, the situations that get really sticky are in these gray areas that fortunately we don't run into a lot of in the galaxy far, far away. But yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, you know, the core component of whether an order is lawful is just that, is somebody, are you being asked to do something that's related to your military duty, that's not, you know, in violation of some, you know, some other law, where a rule of engagement or in a statute.
One of the cases I remember reading from a long time ago, because this comes up in pop culture frequently, the GI was found guilty of obeying a legal order because they had a prisoner, and I don't know if it was a U.S. serviceman or, you know, a foreign combatant. The guy was told to lay down face down on the ground, and his superior said, shoot him. And he shot the guy in the back and killed him. It's like clear, like,
that's so murder.
This is murder. It's like, this isn't combat. Like, this is full on summary execution. So when we get to, when we, you know, come across Saw Gerrera, and the order is like, hey, we have to go kill all these grandmothers and children, you know, and Hunter Wrightley's like, no, like, we are not doing that. And again, as a civilian, I want soldiers thinking like that, being able to go like, time out, like, this is not, we're going home now. We're not slaughtering grandma, because that's what the order said. These are insurgents and we have to go kill them all. No, we don't. Now, if they had taken them into custody, that could have been a different solution. But when you send out the elite commando force of Clone Force 99 to wipe out, you know, insurgents.
Yeah, they're not coming with flex cuffs.
No, it's like they were expecting people to fight.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that situation, were it a little bit different, were it just Saw Gerrera and say some of his soldiers, how Hunter and them would have reacted, because clearly there's an issue there. They had history. They had the Republic had invested quite a bit of, you know, blood and sweat on Onderon throughout the war. They trained, Saw Gerrera's fighters and whatnot, you know, Rex and Anakin and Ahsoka and Obi-Wan all did that sort of personally. And it was critical to the war effort, that planet. And then all of a sudden you're turning around and sending them in there. Regime changes and suddenly you've got an enemy that was your friend yesterday. So how that would have been handled. But yeah, it was fascinating because it's a mixed bunch. And I think Saw probably out of both necessity and strategically doesn't mind commingling his forces like that. A, they're on the run, so there's probably not too many places to go, but B, it might come in handy in situations like that, being able to blend in and out of that protected status as a civilian.
Yeah.
But it's fascinating to see that play out. You think you're going to get a TV show where it's just, you know, like five, six knuckleheads like going around, dropping in, blowing up droids, and then doing their own thing. And instead, within what, 20 minutes of this episode, you get a couple really deep moral and legal dilemmas that they have to work through. And I love that even Wrecker, who's like the dumbest of the bunch, is like, wait a minute, something's not right here. My brain says something wrong.
We're not supposed to just butcher people. This is bad.
Yeah. He's also going to be called Uncle Wrecker from now on, because that's who he is.
Yeah, I've seen that as well. Good for, yeah, good stuff. But the potential war crimes that our heroes avoid, to their credit, is refreshing to go like, nope, let's find out what's going on and not just butcher people. The other thing that was fascinating was when they're back on Kamino, and we get the Emperor's, now Emperor, I've declared myself Emperor's speech, and the clones are all cheering. They're the only ones going like, what? This doesn't seem right. Like, why are, and the clones are no longer like individuals. So like, we don't see like tattoos and like, they're all the same haircut now all of a sudden.
That's a great observation.
Yeah, it's like, ooh, this is, it it's the same model over and over again. Like, this is they've become stormtroopers, and as opposed to the lovable clones that we've seen for 7 seasons and grew to love. So again, it's like very jarring. And it raises interesting questions about how Order 66 worked, because it didn't just trigger kill the Jedi. It's deeper than that from what we can see.
And there was a function of it that ensured that any clone that was out there who might have second thoughts about it was dealt with. And, you know, Rex experienced that firsthand. And they actually said I forget whether it was Rex or Jesse who uttered the line, but basically like, hey, we need to get this right, because if you, the order is execute all Jedi, but also execute anyone who refuses to do Order 66 because they're a traitor. So there's almost this, safety net device, so that any clone that got a little too individualized and maybe was a little wiser to what was going on, or, you know, had some issue with their chip, some of that resistance that had built up, that they would be dealt with in short order by their brothers, no less, as tragic as that is.
Yeah, that's so wrong on so many levels. So they gift wrapped an issue for us with Tarkin trying to nullify the contract
he just does it so quickly. He's like, yeah, it's no good anymore. We're new management.
Yeah, okay. So when the Soviet Union fell, there was a debate about, you know, did the treaties that we had with the Soviet Union, like SALT or the, anti-ballistic missile treaty, did that transfer to the Russian Federation? And, you know, there's like, that's a legitimate discussion, because the government fell and something else rose up. And we all, we're not in the State Department, but it seemed the collective wisdom was, we don't want the proliferation of nuclear weapons, so let's just pretend and, keep it there. Because the treaty is basically a contract between two nations. With this, if we think of our clone manufacturers as a, government supplier, the Empire is really hard pressed to go like, we're not the Republic anymore, and we're not going to honor our old contracts. That's a great way to ensure no one will do business with you. They can't do that in good faith. There's no good faith. That's a chalk outline at this point of the story. If nope, you can see the blaster marks on it. But the idea of, we're just not going to honor the contracts of the Republic because we reorganized and now we're an empire, that doesn't work. It's one thing to go if there's a revolution and, it's like complete new management, like let's just pick on the United States. Let's just say that after, July 4th, 1776 and our victory at Saratoga, like, we weren't going to honor crap that the Brits tried to bind us to. We're a new country now. We're gonna go do our own thing, and here we are. That's not what happened here. Like, it's completely different. This isn't like the Bolsheviks taking, killing the Tsar. This is, hey, we're no longer the Articles of Confederation. We're now the United States of America. So we're gonna have to honor those old treaties that we had, that we just spent years failing because the articles didn't work.
Yeah, and I want to give credit to Aaron, one of our longtime listeners and good friends. We were chatting about the episode, and he actually brought up the Bolshevik Revolution, which I thought was a great point and a good foil to this episode. It'd be one thing if Palpatine had been sort of hanging in the wings, I think, and swept into power. But that was sort of... the exact opposite. He had wormed his way in way before that. This was literally them just picking a new name for their government in its simplest form. It's like if McDonald's like decided, well, we're going to capitalize that little C now and all those contracts. It's under new, you know, we're a new business now. We can't honor any of that anymore.
It's like when people get married, that's your one time, at least in California, that you can completely change your name. So let's just say that the wife takes the husband's last name because that used to be a traditional thing that happened. And it's like, no, you don't understand. My name is Marianne Gilliland now. Marianne Smith is no more. It's like
my car note's gone. I'm sorry. I don't owe you anything, Toyota.
Yeah, it's like, nope. Good try. No, yeah. Like you know, you don't get to do that.
There are huge implications for the Kaminoans here, because you've got to imagine that whether it was the Republic or the Galactic Empire, they didn't care who was in charge. They cared that they had an ongoing contract worth billions, if not trillions, for the provision of the army. And an army that was constantly going to need bodies because of the age out rate. You know, they're aging at twice the normal age. So there's a much, a much smaller window where these clones are combat effective and useful. So that's a very, very lucrative contract. Probably their most lucrative contract, just based on some of the reaction. They were just, Lama Su was like, didn't even know what to say. He's just like, what? But then that's, you know, what on another level, it's completely uneven partners in the game here. I mean, I think at that point in galactic history, the Kaminoans would have had one senator. But that's little weight when you compare to the Galactic Empire, who, you know, they run the government, they own everything. And they also have your entire army that they can turn against you and just wipe Topoka City off the map. Like, bye-bye.
Yeah, you think you would put in a failsafe. If you're going to put in Order 66, you might as well put in Order 70 or maybe Order 2. You don't fire on us.
Don't ask about that one.
Yes. What's Order 2? Here you go. yeah. The... It's just so wrong. The idea of switching from clone to conscription is an interesting one to weigh in on, because I'm not sure what's cheaper, because I think having the clone army actually could be more efficient and cheaper, because they're, you know, the training is very succinct and like that's what those guys are for. On the flip side, conscription is a great way to get everyone on board with service to the Empire, and you don't have an us versus them mindset of the clones are the ones imposing the Empire's will on us. It's like my son went off and joined the Empire, or my daughter is, you know, a weapons specialist. So it's people have that reaction that it's not of occupying army with that setup. Do you have a reaction or thoughts to that?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. And I'm wondering whether there could have been a way for the Empire to get out of the contract by saying, you know, you can no longer meet our needs. We are a Galactic Empire now. The organization is different. We are maybe the same leadership, but we are fundamentally reorganized. And the way that this reorganization is going to, or the requirement for military forces that comes along with this reorganization far outstrips your ability to meet our needs anymore. So therefore it is impossible for you to meet, you know, our new terms under the deal. And so we'll continue buying up clones until the existing stock that you have growing, that's a really weird, callous way of talking about human beings, but the folks that you have embryo and up will take, but after that, we're going to wind it down and there will be no more renewal of this contract. That I could see possibly a legal pathway for. There, you know, the government has, we could do an entire episode on government contracting, but the government has some weird contract vehicles, one of the basic fundamentals of contracts in general in terms of you know, the product that you're delivering when you're talking about delivery of, you know, whether it's clones or widgets, you know, I think there's a fundamental question about the one party's ability to meet the contract. But I don't think Tarkin was interested in getting into an esoteric debate. It was my way or the highway, and let me introduce you to my friend, the Death Star, if not.
Yeah, it's like, I have no problem carpet bombing your island facility on this ocean planet and watching it sink. Yeah. Like, that's not how contract modification is supposed to work. I do think there would have been a better argument for like a force majeure, or the fact that the war's over. Like, yeah, we're done. Yeah. We're not going to keep buying B-17s because we're not bombing Europe anymore. You know, like, our needs are going to change because of that. And they, but again, it was a very Tarkin solution to contract law that an international arbitrator would probably not side with.
Well, look, it would have been funny for him to tell, not that he would have known this, but their planet already doesn't exist on star charts, thanks to Count Dooku, at least in the Jedi archives. It would be nothing to just, when the Death Star was ready, roll it in there in a few years and delete a planet from existence that nobody really knew about to begin with.
Well, but again, that's like 20 years down the road.
So, well, that's true.
So, but they probably have other WMDs that they could use to hit them with. And
with clones, again, to operate them.
Yeah, it's like, do you have the, you know, do we have the equivalent of nuclear weapons here? Because that would solve the problem. But again, when you go to war with your supplier, that's a really bad sign for anyone else that you want a contract with. So, like, ending the contract on good terms of like, we won the war because of them, we'll take the remaining soldiers that are currently in gestation, and we will move on from there. I mean, but it also highlights the danger for a government contractor of putting all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, you because, need to go make a couple other clone armies.
Yeah, it's like, who are you supporting? Some back stuff. Yeah, why do you do this? It's like, this is not a good way to manage a business. You don't want to supply both sides, that's wrong. But if you're supplying allied nations, because like in Rebels, we saw TIE fighters used by the mining guild that had been modified, mm-hmm. one less solar panel on it, and they had a different paint scheme. But they were, again, Imperial TIE fighters. So like whoever was making those was selling them to another party. Do that.
So Jabba the Hutt's got his own little clone army there on Tatooine running around.
Well, then, and you know, are there other species that you know that you could have? Is there?
Well, and I, you know, we won't get into speculation in this episode, but I suspect that Omega, as cute as she is one of those ventures that they were looking at, because there's that great line from, it's either Cut or Hunter that in the second episode that talks about, you know, the Kaminoans don't do anything without a purpose. They have a reason for, they're not just flippantly out there doing stuff. So I suspect we're going to learn a lot more on that front.
So what I think would be fun to see with her is that she's a clone of a Jedi from the High Republic era. So that way there could be a nice connection to the books right. that are coming out. I also get it could think we're just playing with Jango Fett's DNA and they made a female clone. But since she behaves so differently, I think there could be another donor at play.
Yeah, I think you're right with the, I think they were secretly getting into the business of trying to replicate force use, because what else? I mean, that ties beautifully into the Mandalorian, and I don't want to slip us down a rabbit hole, but ties beautifully into The Mandalorian and some of the stuff that we've seen nugget wise on the Imperial side there. It just is a fascinating narrative sort of behind the scenes and an opportunity to plug a lot of other stuff into this. And she also doesn't look like the other clones. So something's different there. And they don't need, the Kaminoans have perfected, as far as they're concerned, the normal fighting soldier. They're proud of their combat education program. There's not really much in the way of innovations that they can come to at that point. So what's the next hot selling product that they could come up with? A force user. Hey, who helped win the Clone War? Well, our clones did, but also the Jedi. Now we can sell you both.
Yeah, there's a... Yeah, I think she's force sensitive, because like her discussion with Crosshairs, that's basically, I know what the future is. It's like, that's a big... big clue, because that's going beyond she's sensitive and she's observant to, I now know the future and I forgive you for what you're going to do. Like, that, there's a lot there to unpack. Here's the thing, I like the kid. So we don't have Phantom Menace annoying child problem. Nor do we have a Wesley Crusher situation where Wesley saves the ship once again. Like, we, you know, like that got very annoying in season one of Next Generation, of like, sure. she's clearly a kid, but we're now seeing she's got skills and she's, you know, what, looks up to Hunter in a fatherly manner, mm-hmm. Wrecker plays with her like a fun uncle, and you know, like both passed out after exploring the ship. Like, it's just people in, like, I didn't feel this way about Ezra, but there were people who thought Ezra was annoying, like, and I was never in that camp. There were people who thought Ahsoka was annoying at the beginning, and there's merit to that at the beginning. And then they quickly learned to regret it because competent writers came in. They're writing Omega exceptionally well.
Yeah.
It's she behaves like a human kid who is hanging out with her uncles, watching them do things, wants to be with them, you know, is concerned that, did I do something wrong? It's just like, it's really well done. And it works for me. And like, they're not doing the Grogu path either, where like, we're not seeing a Mudhorn floating. So it's a very different approach. And I really like what they're doing. Do you have reactions?
Yeah, she's also at a different point in her life too. So Grogu, you get sort of the experience of caring for a toddler. She, especially in the second episode, you see it's the trials and tribulations of caring for an older kid who's still, she's very sheltered. She's never been off Kamino, that much is clear. And she's still exploring and learning what emotions are, interacting with people. I mean, you see her with the two kids there, Shia and Jack, Cut's kids. And it's like, she doesn't know what playing ball is or like what it is to have fun. It's all like, her life up to that point has all been purpose-driven, you know, do what the Kaminoans say and, you know, accomplish whatever the mission of the day is. And now she just has to be a kid and it's not easy. And there's that like really touching moment that I'll fully admit made me cry a little bit, where, you know, Hunter sort of confronts her, like, what were you doing going outside the fence there? And Cut comes in, clone from the same DNA, but he's like, she didn't know any better. She's just a kid. And he takes her up in his arms and she's, you know, got her head buried in his shoulder. It's just like a really poignant moment. And it's very different than, you know, anything we've seen with Grogu. But it's funny, with Grogu aside, It's like every young Star Wars character that we've gotten in remotely this mold, people have this same sort of knee-jerk reaction. And I will put credits down now that either by the end of this season or next, people will be big, big fans of Omega, that she will have won over a lot of the doubters, and some of the same people that are distasteful of her right now will be her biggest fans. So, and that's a good thing. You know, I want her to be, it's like, as a dad of two girls, I can't not sort of imprint myself and our family on that situation. So I'd like some of Wrecker's extra strength, though. I'll admit that, or maybe Hunter's tracking skills.
She's somewhere between 8 to 10 is my guess. And it works great. Like she's a good character, and I'm all on board. And if anyone doesn't like her, I think that's it's clearly something up with them that they need to explore their souls on. And because again, we're not seeing, it's nothing over the top. You know, she's a kid. And again, her ability to do that magnificent shot on Crosshairs, it's like, okay, she's enhanced or force sensitive. It's one or the other, because, you know, a normal 10-year-old would not be able to do that. So there's definitely a skill there. But her, the reactions with her, of her, you know, like the boys get thrown into the brig, like her reaction of like waving at them, like with the like, hi, like just adorable. Like, it's like kids would do that. Like that's what kids do.
Oopsies.
Or the running out with the chain codes to get them to Cut's family. It's like, okay, like she's useful. It's not over the top. It wasn't like she programmed the chain codes. Like we're not dealing with stuff that's way above her weight, you know, responding to. It's a good thing. Like, and I like the character. They also needed a female from a storytelling perspective, because if you had a Disney show with just 5 dudes, that's a problem.
Yeah, you know, that's like, an issue.
That's just, you can't do that. Like, you just can't.
They could just rename this Omega and her 5 dads.
Yeah.
That would be acceptable. But it also gives, it gives a good challenge, a narrative challenge for the 5 clones, because they're experts at what they do. They're better than any other soldier at the business of fighting. But this is a set of challenges that they didn't even know existed. I mean, they're running into things already that they're just not fully equipped to deal with. And I thought it was just so poignant, Hunter learning some of those lessons early on from a fellow clone. Uh-huh. And I thought that this brings up, one of the issues that we had spotted for this episode, which was desertion. But we talk about those connections back to the original Clone Wars series, and they announced that they were going to Sulukumai, and I was like, I'm sitting there watching, I'm like, this is purposeful. Cut? No, they couldn't be going back to see Cut. And then sure enough, they go back and see Cut Law Kane, his wife Sue, and their 2 kids. Actually, they didn't show the 2 kids. I was like, oh, tell me they didn't grow. Like, I'm like doing the math in my head, like, are they old enough now to be off planet? Like, no, can we please see the kids? And then they come running in. So I thought that was just an awesome little tie back and ended up being a really meaningful one.
Yeah, because they, one, I had a guess. It's like, who do they know that, okay, well, who else is on the run? And it's like, well, the deserter would be the guy. And they don't need the backstory of how they met.
Yeah.
Like, we just, Star Wars is really good at going, you were in the Clone Wars? And that's all that's said in 1977, and no one blinks an eye. Or the spice mines of Kessel. no one blinks an eye and wants an in-depth discussion about, you know, write a four-page treatise on what that means. And it's a sidetrack from the plot. They knew him. Cool. We're off and running. Works for me. Like, not, we don't need a backstory for every meeting that ever takes place. That said, it was good to see him, and it raises issues of, you know, like the building off like the contract issue. Can you desert a nation that doesn't exist anymore? Because if they're going to take the position that contracts aren't the same because the Republic's no more, then people who were members of the Grand Army of the Republic should be free. Because it's like, I didn't take an oath to the Empire. And if you guys are going to play that game, bye-bye. You know, like, I'm leaving. I'm not going to be part of war crimes.
Yeah. What it's weird. You know, I don't know how the Empire view, like, are they viewed as chattel? Are they viewed as, you know, basically military equipment that the Republic has acquired by contract from the Kaminoans? Because it, I mean, that's, they're bought, they're sold and bought, you know, in Attack of the Clones. And so these are, to a T, all extensions of that contract. But, you know, I don't know that the changeover, and again, because there's no changeover in regime, it's same car, different name slapped on it. So I don't know if functionally that really makes a difference. And it creates, I think that's at the heart of the danger. It's always been at the heart of danger for Cut, because as a deserter, legally the jurisdiction of the army is still in you. Those jurisdictional hooks, I would call them, are still in you. Typically, and this is just an odd function of active duty, once you leave service, the military's ability to prosecute you for crimes done while you were in uniform, even crimes that are still within the statute of limitations, it's gone. Jurisdiction's gone. There are exceptions to that. So we can bring retirees back. So if Cut had been, you know, like Rex or Wolf, like one of the, well, Rex is not a good example, but like Wolf or maybe presumably Gregor that we see in Rebels, like retired clones that are out there still kind of doing like a reservist job or something for the Empire. Yeah, maybe they could be brought back in. But under traditional terms, once your service is up, you're gone. And even if they were investigating you as you left, if somehow you're allowed to leave and your active duty time isn't extended by, you know, one means or another, so much, you know, so long, unless the government itself can prosecute you for something under civilian law. Desertion is different because you continue to carry that status. It would have been the same with Han Solo after his desertion from the Empire, like, you know what, several years before A New Hope. I mean, he theoretically, up until the day the Empire ceased to exist, would have been prosecutable as a deserter. And, you know, so that danger always existed. And that was sort of part of the episode where they introduced him in the Clone Wars. Like, Rex makes this decision not to turn him in. But it's a huge danger for him here. He's around all of these clones, Seleukomized, now infested with them. And he's going right sort of into the heart of town and is taking an awful risk with his family right there with him.
Yeah, I would have... I understand running with the, you know, the Bad Batch, they're wanted men, but so's he. So I think it would have been less risky for them to fly off in the Havoc Marauder and get dropped off on some other planet and be like, see ya. And it's like, good luck farming here and go for it. And, but that would be my risk assessment of like what's, you know, like it's almost like a Cold War style story of having the right forged papers so you can get out of the Eastern Bloc or get across the Berlin Wall and, you know, escape into freedom. But yeah, I mean, it was well done. It was good for storytelling purposes, but I would have gone with a different plan. But that's that's me. Yeah, you know, the other issue is, do you think, you know, the Empire could prosecute Cut for desertion from the Republic? Yes or no, or maybe?
I mean, it depends. I think yes on a variety of levels. I guess we know that they were in the business of court-martialing their property, if that's what they consider them to be. We saw that repeatedly during the Clone Wars. And so I think they would take the view that, yeah, we changed names, but I don't care what we're doing with government contracts with suppliers. You're still our soldiers. And who are you going to appeal to? We own the courts too, so you're not going to have any luck anywhere. You know, because traditionally, if you don't like a ruling out of a military court, you appeal to a military court, you appeal to a superior level military court, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, or CAF for short. And that court sits one under the U.S. Supreme Court. So you do have from time to time cases bubble up out of CAF that get granted review by the United States Supreme Court. And theoretically, you've got a body of non-military members that can look at a case clean, you know, at whatever standard of review they're looking at, but they're not influenced because of a uniform that they wear, that they don't view the case with that same lens, like a military appellate judge who's still an active duty officer might see the case in. That's not going to help the clones here, because I think even if that sort of framework traditionally exists in the Empire, Palpatine owns all of that. You're going to be out of luck. So I think Cut, for him, it's escape or die trying. And at the very least, get your family off if you have to go down in a blaze of glory. So I love the tension that all that created with all of them sort of in the proverbial crosshairs. And there was that moment where the trooper that was helping facilitate shuttle boarding is like, "You look familiar," and then he gets drawn away and you're like, "Oh."
Again, very World War II movies, The Great Escape, you know, just forge papers trying to get out of Dodge, you know, board the plane to freedom. And again, it's nice seeing the Star Tours model, which means that cruiser designs in service for like 40 years. So like that'd be like flying an L-1011, you know, today. It's like, sure, it could be done, but I'm not sure how many airlines are still flying planes from 1970 in their fleet. So
Spirit probably is. I don't know.
Yeah. Does the cabin pressurize? Good enough. While we talk about chain codes for a minute, because that seems to be, it's like more than a social security number. It turns into more than a social security number. So the on one level, it doesn't make sense for the Empire to not have government issue ID. Like we have social security numbers, which allow people to get jobs. You get state issued driver's licenses or IDs so you can, you know, open a bank account. And again, social security numbers needed for that. We have birth certificates. So, you know, there's documentation that follows you around throughout life. That apparently didn't exist in the Republic, and that's just weird. The idea that the Empire is, you know, branding people with numbers, you know, and like, how deep does it go? Because when we get to the Mandalorian, our trackers, they're not sniffing out an ID card. They're sniffing out people, meaning that it's tied to your genetic code somehow. If it turns into that, that makes sense. But if this is the first version of it, that's fascinating. And it also raises the issue that I bet Luke didn't have one looping off, and same with, you know, Ben Kenobi, So living completely off the grid, they were not in a government database that would have triggered any alarms for people to go look for them, because they literally did not have like our equivalent of a social security number.
Yeah, just running an illegal moisture farm there outside of Mos Eisley.
Yeah, it's just, it's like people living in Hoovervilles, you know, at that point. It's very odd. But again, it would be like free Roosevelt United, as in Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
When it's interesting, because they don't mention it, it's a way of keeping tabs on everybody, but at least unless I missed it, there wasn't a discussion of tracking people with it, other than, hey, your chain code was scanned here, it's tied to this departure flight to this planet, we know where you've gone, and you need to use that every time you run registered transport. So there's a way to do that, the same that, you know, I'm sure you could be tracked, just showing your ID to TSA and booking a ticket from place to place on air travel or something like that. But there's no mention of like a biological connection or anything like that to it. And you see, we don't know all of the elements of a chain code. We know from The Mandalorian that your age is a part of it. And so, but I don't know that there's any like genetic material or anything like that.
Yeah. But with Boba Fett showing the armor was his. So,
yeah. And it showed his a little bit of his ancestry. I mean, there were people out there that had translated the Mandoa on it. And it's a little bit more than your birth date and, you know, your current address.
They, you know, again, this is week one of the Empire. So it would make sense if they keep developing the technology. And if it got to the point you didn't need a card, it was, you know, a thumbprint, and that read your genetic markers, that if they went that far with it. But again, that's speculation. And it makes sense if it's physical media in the first week of the Galactic Empire, because it's week one. Like, yeah. They're rolling out government ID for the first time. But it's like watching the old airport disaster movies, because they're incompatible with today. Like the first one, which is, I think it's just airport. You know, you have someone who sneaks a bomb on board an airplane because there's no X-ray machines. There's right. Like, there's no TSA like inspecting, you know, luggage. And you actually have one of the, what would have been like a TSA officer go like, God, that guy acted weird. I wish I could inspect his suitcase. like alien to us, like that plot wouldn't work today. It's like, are you kidding? Like, so maybe we're in that stage of galactic history with Star Wars. But it is weird not having ID. Like that's just bonkers to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
That said, we do have impounded vehicles. Cars get impounded all the time. Airplanes can too. So can boats.
But were they impounding all vehicles on the planet and forcing all traffic to go through that port? Was that what was happening there?
That's the way I read it. And they were also picking up abandoned vehicles. At least that's right. How they, you know, played it with the Havoc Marauder. I hope that's the right name for their ship.
No, you got it right. Okay. I wish they would have to do like, what, you know, the sort of informal rule along the highway. If you abandon your car, you hang like a little white something out of it to indicate that it's broken down.
and that would make sense immediately after a war, that you're going to have abandoned vehicles lying around. I mean, heck, they just, you know, somebody just excavated a World War I tank out of mud in France. So it's like, things get left behind.
Especially on a planet like that, where there was heavy combat for quite a while. So yeah, that makes sense. I couldn't tell whether they were impounding like everybody's personal ship. Like, this is just your little puddle jumper. We're going to take that and put it here in this impound lot.
I think they were in order to tag them with identification. And again, like, airplanes have transponders that broadcast like an ID number. Cars have VIN numbers. You would think spaceships would have something, unless it was completely homemade, and being able to tell that, you know, they have serial numbers. They, you know, like on the sunken wreck of the USS Lexington, which is in like, you know, 9,000 feet of water, something insane. One of the aircraft carriers we lost during the Battle of the Coral Sea. The planes that were, that went down with her are well preserved. Mm-hmm. So they were able to read the parts numbers on, you know, like what was visible. And they figured out the pilot of the plane who lived until like 2014.
Wow.
So, yeah. And so, so like there were interviews with him that existed since, like, you know, they didn't find it till like what, 2018, but they were at least able to go like, that was Bob's airplane. And like, and here's his story that's connected to that airplane on the bottom of the Pacific. So you think there would be things like that for the, you know, all the aircraft that exist in the Star Wars universe. But if not, God, the documentation that would need to happen. That is nuts. And it's bonkers to think that people were just like freewheeling, like with, it'd be like not having an FCC and people just have radio stations. It's like, you can't regulate me. I do what I want here.
And it's possible, they're never going to get into this level of detail probably, except in a visual guide. But it's possible that this was driven by, like, all of a sudden, a lot of worlds that were contested that maybe had seceded from the Republic were now under Imperial control. And you had to extend a certain amount of bureaucracy to sort of bring things into line. It was about control. It was about sort of a power grab, obviously. But on another level, there was a logistical reason for it, too. And we know, at least by the time of Rebels and A New Hope, that they have that sort of thing, because like the ghost masks it, like that's one of its biggest features, is its ability to mask its signature, or you know, sort of scramble itself, go invisible off that stuff. You also see the Razor Crest has an old Imperial ID, and it's just odd the way it shows up on sensors and stuff, and so that becomes a thing. But it's a total normal logistical part. I'm sure that the Imperial military never ever misused that information for its own purposes.
Yeah, it's the Germans were really good at record keeping, which is why we have the privacy rules that Europe has today, because they're still freaked out about that and what it was used for. So it's one thing to have driver's licenses. It's another thing to have lists of people. And like, we do that for the census in order to determine how many, you know, congressmen and women that's, you know, states get. You know, it helps federal funding. This is not for an altruistic reason. No. Like, this is, they're, you know, again, they want the, you know, population to live in fear. So they're not nice people. No.
That's the understatement of the episode.
No, oh, God. So did you spot any other issues that you think we need to address?
No, I think we hit the biggest ones, like my favorite ones. I mean, we'll probably get into some more Grogu-esque legal issues with where Omega stands and the sort of her status and in relation to the Bad Batch as we see that relationship grow. But yeah, this was fast. It's awesome to get a chance to talk about legal issues connected back into Order 66, because we got to talk about it a teeny little bit during season 7 with the Siege of Mandalore arc. But it's cool to get to talk about you know, something that really originated, that, that was first seen on screen in what, 05,
yeah,
in Revenge of the Sith, and now we get to kind of analyze it through a brand new lens, which is cool.
Agreed. And again, there's issues with guardianship with her that are going to be fascinating to weigh in on, and personhood for the clones as well.
I suspect the Kaminoans aren't going to be too keen on losing her, assuming she's one of a kind at this point. And so I don't know whether you see somebody like Fennec Shand or, you know, so you pick your other nefarious character that gets involved in an effort to get Omega back to Kamino. But that'll be an interesting subplot. It'll provide us with plenty of issues, I'm sure.
This is also the second Star Wars series where we're seeing someone trying to be a good parental figure.
Yeah.
Because the original series did not have that. I mean, like, Uncle Owen comes across as a schmuck at best. And, you know, and, you know, Peru is, you know, seems sweet, but like, it's very short lived. And none of the other series, I mean, well, Shimi seemed like a good mom.
Yeah, again, that's true.
But again, very little time with her. So Mandalorian was, I think, the most positive parental figure that we've had in Star Wars to date. And it looks like they're going that path again with Hunter, with a older child, even though she's 40 years, or well, at this point in time, Grogu's still probably like, what, 20, you know, in comparison to her. But that's fascinating that we're seeing good parents. And like that, we really haven't seen that before with any of the main characters. Mm-hmm. Maybe in some of the animated series with side characters. But in like Kaz, you know, he and his dad had issues. Like, yeah, it wasn't a healthy parental relationship. And Ezra, I mean, they were dead. So right, like, he didn't, he did in the past, but like not during the series. And like, and
yeah, then,
unless we start counting Hera and Kanan as parental figures.
Space, like, mom and space dad.
Yeah,
but it's all about adoptive families across the board. You don't, and this would sort of roll right into it. And I guess it depends on maybe how you see her in terms of the bloodline there, whether she's a clone of Jango or not. But still, it's a great story to tap into, and one that I think, what if the episodes have proven anything, we're not going to be retreading old tires here. So I think you're going to see something new. We've already seen something new in terms of their relationship. And really, I'm just here for all the Hunter and Omega shenanigans. They can mess around and just like play like kids, you know, Wrecker with his little Tuca stuffed Tuca bear. And
I just, again, like seeing that the big guy who likes to blow stuff up has a stuffed animal that he likes to sleep with. That's, again, you start thinking mental health issues. You know, and like, okay, that's clearly important to him. I just, like, it bothers me. Like, if he,
this is the most not an obscure reference, but just a ridiculous one. The first thing that it honestly made me think of was, if you remember Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2, the movie, what everybody thought was going to be Rocksteady and Bebop, Toka and Rezar. There's this scene where the, like, Shredder realizes that they're infantile, and he just goes, "They're babies." For whatever reason, that just popped into my head as I was looking at Hunter, like, so happy that his little stuffed animal had been found.
Yeah, I think more in terms of remembering stuffed animals from my childhood, you know. Yeah. And it's like, okay, been there, done that. I hope he's reunited. and the guy who likes to, you know, do curls with a power droid. So, which again, I don't know if that's, that could be abuse of the droid, because that he did not seem happy with being reduced to a dumbbell. But hey, he's not target practice. He doesn't seem to be not getting hurt, but doesn't look comfortable. Oh, with that, this has been fun, and we will keep covering these. And I know there are other lawyers who will jump in as well, so it won't just be Tom and I. But everyone, stay safe, stay healthy, stay geeky, and may the force be with you.